Me. Silverlock. King Conan. He'd packed books not to entertain, nor even to illustrate philosophies of life, but to rebuild civilization. Even Dole's habitable planets for man. Damn it, no. Dan tossed habitable planets for man on the table. Fat chance that the next incarnation of NASA would need it before it turned to dust. But so what? He added more. Future Shock. Cults of Unreason. Dante's Inferno. Tau Zero. Stop. 15 minutes later, he had finished. There were no more bags. He drank coffee that was still warm and forced himself to rest before he tackled the heavy work. His watch said it was 10 at night. He couldn't tell. He wheeled a wheelbarrow in from the garage. It was brand new, the labels still on it. He resisted the temptation to overload it. He donned raincoat, boots, hat. He wheeled the books out through the garage. Tuhunga's modern sewage system was relatively new. The territory was dotted with abandoned septic tanks, and one of these was behind Dan Forrester's house. It was uphill. You can't have everything. The wind screamed. The rain tasted both salty and gritty. The lightning guided him, but badly. Dan wrestled the wheelbarrow uphill, looking for the septic tank. He finally found it, full of rain, because he'd removed the lid yesterday evening. The books went in handfuls. He pushed them into the aged sewage with a plumber's helper, gently. Before he left, he broke open an emergency flare and left it on the upended lid. He made his second trip in a bathing suit. The warm, lashing rain was less unpleasant than soaked and sticky clothes. The third trip, he wore the hat. He almost fainted coming back. That wouldn't do. He'd better have a rest. He took off the wet suit and stretched out on the couch, pulled a blanket over himself, and fell deeply asleep. He woke in a pandemonium of thunder and wind and rain. He was horribly stiff. He got to his feet an inch at a time and kept moving toward the kitchen, talking encouragement to himself. Breakfast first, then back to work. His watch had stopped. He didn't know if it was day or night. Fill the wheelbarrow half full, no more. Wheel it through slippery mud, uphill. Next trip, remember to take another flare. Dump the books by armfuls, then push them down into the old sewage. Unlikely that anyone, moron or genius, would look for such a treasure here, even if he knew it existed. The smell hardly bothered him, but these hurricane winds couldn't last forever, and then the trove would be doubly safe. Back for another load. Once he slipped, and slid a fair distance downhill through the mud, with the empty wheelbarrow tugging him along. He crossed just enough sharp rocks to dissuade him from trying it again. Then, last load. Finished. He wrestled with the lid, rested, tried again. He'd had a hell of a time getting it off, and he had a hell of a time getting it back on. Then, downhill with the empty barrow. In a day, his tracks would be flooded away. He thought of burying the last evidence of his project, the wheelbarrow, but just the thought of all that work made him hurt all over. He dried himself with all the towels in the bathroom. Why not? He used the same towels to dry the rain gear. He got more from the linen closet. He stuffed hand towels into the boots before he put them in the car, with the raincoat and the hat and more dry towels. The old house leaked now. He wondered if the old car would, too. Ultimately, it wouldn't matter. Ultimately, he would have to abandon the car and set out on foot in the rain, carrying a backpack for the first time in his life. He'd be safe, or dead, long before this rain began to think about stopping. Into the car went the new backpack he'd packed day before yesterday, including a hypo and some insulin. There were two more such medical packages elsewhere in the car, because someone might steal the whole backpack, or someone might steal the hypos, but surely they would leave him one. The car was an ancient heap, and nothing in it would attract thieves. He'd included a few items to buy his life, if and when it could be bought. There was one really valuable item, It would look like trash to the average looter, but it might get him to safety. Daniel Forrester, Ph.D., was a middle-aged man with no useful profession. His doctorate would never again be worth as much as a cup of coffee. His hands were soft, he weighed too much, he was a diabetic. Friends had told him that he often underestimated his own worth. Well, that was bad, too, because it restricted his bargaining ability. He knew how to make insulin. It took a laboratory and the killing of one sheep per month. Yesterday, Dan Forrester had become an expensive luxury. What was in his backpack was something else again. It was a book, wrapped like the others, Volume 2 of The Way Things Work. Volume 1 was in the septic tank. Harvey Randall saw the white Cadillac coming toward him. For a moment, it didn't register. Then he jammed on the brakes so hard that Joanna was thrown forward against the restraining belts. The shotgun clattered hard against the dash. "You gone crazy!" she yelled, but Harvey had already opened the door and was running out into the street. He waved his arms frantically. God, she had to see him! "Marie!" he shouted. The Cadillac slowed, halted. Harvey ran up to it. Incredibly, Marie Vance was unruffled. She wore a Gernreich original, a simple, low-cut summer dress of white linen with a golden thread woven into it. Gold earrings and a small diamond pendant on a gold chain set it off perfectly. Her dark hair was coming out of place from the damp, but it wasn't long hair and had never been fully curled. Even now she looked as if she'd merely been at the country club all day and was going home to change into evening clothes. Harvey looked at her in astonishment. She eyed him calmly. His dislike of her boiled up inside him. He wanted to scream at her, to ruffle her. Didn't she realize? "How did you get here?" he demanded. When she answered, he was ashamed of himself. Marie Vance spoke calmly, too calmly. There was an undertone of unnatural effort in her voice. "I came up the ridge. There were cars in the way, but some men moved them. I went..." "Why do you want to know how I got here, Harvey?" He laughed at himself, at the world, and she was frightened at his laughter. He could see the fear come into her eyes. Mark drove up on the motorcycle. He looked at the Cadillac, then at Marie. He didn't whistle. "Your neighbor?" he asked. "Yes. Marie, you'll have to come with us. You can't stay at your place."
"I've no intention of staying at my place," she said. "I'm going to find my son. And Gordy," she added after a tiny pause. She looked down at her gold-colored sandals. "When I get some clothes... Harvey, where is..."
Before she could finish, she saw the pain, then the numbness in Harvey's eyes. "Loretta," she said, her voice low and wondering. Harvey said nothing. Mark, behind him, shook his head slowly. His eyes met Marie's. She nodded. Harvey Randall turned away. He stood in the rain, saying nothing, looking at nothing.
"Leave the caddy and get in the travel-all," Mark said.
"No," Marie tried to smile. "Please, can't you wait until I get some clothes? Harvey..."
"He's not making decisions just now," Mark said. "Look, there'll be clothes. Not much food, but plenty of clothes."
"I have perfectly good outdoor equipment at home," Marie was firm. She knew how to talk to employees, Gordy's or Harvey's. "And boots that fit. I am very hard to fit. You can't tell me that 10 minutes will make that much difference."
"It'll take longer than 10 minutes, and we don't have any time at all," Mark said.
"It certainly will take longer if we stand here talking about it."
Marie started the car. She began moving forward slowly.
"Please wait for me," she said, and drove away, south.
"Jesus," Mark said.
"Harv."
"What?" He let his question stay unfinished. Harvey Randall wasn't making decisions just now.
"Get in the goddamn car, Harv," Mark ordered.
The bark in Mark's voice moved Harvey toward the travel-all. He started to get into the driver's seat. Mark growled,
"Joanna, take the bike. I'll drive."
"Where?"
"Back to Harvey's place, I guess. Hell, I don't know what we ought to do. Maybe we ought to just go on."
We can't leave her, Joanna said firmly. She got out and took the bike. Mark shrugged and climbed into the travel-all. He managed to turn in a drive and started back the way they'd come, cursing all the way. When they reached the cul-de-sac, Marie Vance was sitting on her front porch. She wore trousers of an expensive artificial fabric. They were cut in a rugged square pattern and looked very durable. She wore a cotton blouse and a wool Pendleton shirt over it. She was lacing medium-height hiking boots over wool socks. A blanket lay beside her. The blanket was lumpy. Joanna braked the motorcycle on the lawn. Mark got out and joined her. He stared at Marie, then back at Joanna.
God damn, that's the quickest change I've ever seen. She could be useful.
Depends on for what, Marie said evenly. Who are you two, and what's wrong with Harvey? She went on lacing her boots.
His wife was killed. Same outfit that broke into your place, Mark said. Listen, where were you going in that caddy? Is your husband with Andy Randall?
Yes, of course, Marie said. Andy and Bert are up there, with Gordy. She tied the boot and stood. Poor Loretta. She... Oh, damn it. Will you tell me your names?
Mark. This is Joanna. I worked for Harv...
Yes, Marie said. She'd heard about Mark. Hello. You're staying with Harvey, then?
Sure.
Then let's go. Please put this bundle in the car. I'll be right out.
Hard as fucking nails, Mark thought. Coldest bitch I ever saw.
He took the blanket. It was lumpy with clothing and other objects. Marie came out with a plastic travel bag, the kind used to hang clothes when carried on board an airplane. There wasn't a lot of room in the back of the travel-all, but she was careful about how she laid it, smoothing out wrinkles.
"What's all that?" Mark demanded.
"Things I'll need. I'm ready now."
"Can you drive Harvey's buggy?"
"On roads," Marie said. "I've never tried to drive except on roads, but I can handle a stick shift."
"Good. You drive. It's too big for Joanna."
"I can manage."
"Sure, Joe, but you don't have to," Mark said. Let Miss Marie,
she laughed, hard. "It's just Marie, and I'll drive. Do you have maps?" "I don't have a good map. I know the boys are up near the southern edge of Sequoia National Park, but I'm not sure how to get there." Dressed in trousers and wool shirt, thin nylon jacket she'd brought from the house, hiking boots, she looked smaller than Mark remembered, and somehow less competent. Mark had no time to wonder why.
"She'll have to do," Mark thought. "I'll lead on the bike. Joanna will ride shotgun in the car. I think we ought to put Harv in the back seat. Maybe if he gets some sleep, his brain will turn on again. Christ, I never saw a guy go to pieces like that before. It's like he killed her himself."
Mark saw Marie's eyes widen slightly. To hell with that, he thought. He went to the bike and kicked it into life. They went back out, turned north again. The road was deserted. Mark wondered where to go now. He could ask Harv, but would he get the right answer, and how would he know if he did? Why the hell is he so broke up about it, Mark wondered. He wasn't much wife anyway. Never went anywhere with Harv. Good looker, but not much of a companion. Why get so broke up? If Mark had to bury Joanna, he'd hate it, but it wouldn't break him apart. He'd still function, and he'd turn a glass over for her next time he had a drink. And Harv had always been tough. Mark glanced at his watch. Getting late. Time to move fast through what was left of Burbank and the San Fernando Valley. How? If the freeways weren't down, they'd be packed with cars. No good. He thought of routes and wished Harvey's head was working again, but it wasn't, and it was up to Mark to lead. When he reached Mulholland, he turned left. The horn sounded behind him. Marie had stopped at the intersection. "This isn't the way," she shouted.
"Sure it is. Come on."
"No." God damn it. Mark drove back to the travel hall. Marie and Joanna sat tensely in the front seat. The shotgun was poised in Joanna's hands, pointing upward. Marie sat with one arm carelessly near the gun. She was a lot bigger than Joanna.
What is this?
Mark demanded.
The boys. We are going to find our boys, Marie said, and they are east of us, not west.
Hell, I know that, Mark shouted. This is the best way. Stay on high ground. We get across the valley on Topanga, stay along the Santa Susana Hills, and go up through the canyons. That keeps us off the freeways and out of the passes where everybody else will be.
Marie frowned, trying to imagine a map of the L.A. Basin. Then she nodded. That route would take them to Sequoia. She started the car moving again. Mark roared on ahead. As he drove, he muttered to himself. Frank Stoner had said the Mojave was the place to be. Stoner knew everything. It was good enough for Mark. It was a place to go, and once there they could figure out what to do next. It was a destination. But Harv would want to get his kid out, and that Vance woman wanted hers. Funny, she barely mentioned her husband. Maybe they didn't get along. Mark remembered Marie as he'd first seen her. Class. Lots of it. That might be interesting stuff. They drove on through the rain, across the backbone of Los Angeles, and the rain kept them from seeing the destruction in the valleys to either side. The roads were clear of traffic, and the travelall got over the rapidly building piles of mud wherever the road dipped below the ridgeline. They were making miles, and Mark was pleased. Randall dozed and woke, dozed and woke. The car seat jolted and tilted and jerked. Thunder and rain roared in his ears. His own ghastly memories kept pulling him almost awake. When lightning flashed, he saw it again. His strobe-lit living room, crystal and silver intact, dog and wife dead on the kashdan rug. When voices came, he thought he was hearing his own thoughts.
Yes, they were very close. She was completely dependent on him.
The voices faded in and out. Once he was aware that the car had stopped, and there were three voices speaking in a tangle, but they might have been inside his head, too.
Wife is dead.
Wasn't there.
Yes, she said she was going to ask him to stay home. Lost his house and his job and everything he owned.
Not just his job, but whole profession. There won't be any more television documentaries for 1,000 years. Jesus, Mark, you'd be a basket case, too.
I know, but didn't expect. Curl up and die.
Curl up and die, Randall thought. Yeah. He curled tighter in the car seat. The car began moving again, and it jolted him. He whimpered. Tuesday afternoon. Unhappily, where matters as basic as territorial defense are concerned, our higher brain centers are all too susceptible to the urgings of our lower ones. Intellectual control can help us just so far, but no further. In the last resort, it is unreliable, and a single, unreasoned emotional act can undo all the good it has achieved. Desmond Morris, The Naked Ape. For 2 hours the Earth had turned while Hammerlab made one circle and a fraction more. Europe and West Africa had moved from sunset to night. Perhaps they were all afraid to speak. Rick knew he was. If he spoke, what would come out? Johnny's ex-wife and children had not been in Texas. Rick hated him for it. A shameful secret. He watched the turning Earth in silence. It was hot in Hammerlab. Sweat didn't run in free fall, it stayed where it formed. When Rick remembered, he mopped it away with the soggy cloth clutched in his left hand. When tears formed, they covered the eyes like thickening lenses. Blinking only distorted the lenses. They had to be mopped away, and then he saw. Orange holes glowed on the dark earth, like cigarettes poked through the back of a map. Hard to tell where each glowing spot was. City lights had disappeared across Europe, covered by clouds, or simply gone. Sea looked like land. Rick had watched land become sea in places, down the American East Coast and across Florida, and deep into Texas. Texas. Could an army helicopter move faster than a wall of water? But the winds? No, she was dead. But he'd seen the strikes in daylight, and Rick remembered. The glow in the Mediterranean had died away. The smaller Baltic strike had been quenched almost immediately. Much bigger strikes in the mid-Atlantic still showed. You saw only a diffuse pearly glow until Hammerlab was right above one. Then you looked down into the clear center of the tremendous hurricane, down through a clear pillar of live steam into an orange-white glare. Three of these, and they were much smaller now. The sea was returning. Four small, bright craters scattered across the Sudan, and three in Europe, and a much larger one near Moscow, still shed their orange-white light back to space. Johnny Baker sighed and thrust himself back from the window. He cleared his throat and said, "All right, we have things to discuss." They looked at him as if he had interrupted a eulogy. Johnny went doggedly on. "We can't use the Apollo. That big Pacific strike was practically on our recovery fleet. The Apollo's built for sea landings and the sea, all the oceans, hell." "You must beg a ride home," Peter Jakov said, nodding. "Yes, we have room. Accept our hospitality." Leonila Malik said, "We have no home. Where shall we go?"
"Moskva is not all of the Soviet Union," Peter said, gently, reprovingly.
"Isn't it?"
Rick was giving him no help. He was framed in the window, and Johnny saw only his back.
"Glaciers," Johnny said.
Yes, he had their attention.
"There was a strike above Russia in the Kara Sea. We did not see it. It would have been too far north. We only infer it from the way the clouds swept down."
"The clouds swept down, right. That had to be an ocean strike. The clouds will keep coming down across Russia till the crater on the seabed is quenched. They'll dump tens of millions of tons of snow all across the continent. White clouds and white snow. Any sunlight that falls will be reflected back to space for the next couple of hundred years.
Johnny's face twisted. "God knows I hate to ruin your day, but those glaciers are going to sweep right down to China. I really think we ought to head for someplace warm."
Peter Jakov's face was cold. He said, "Perhaps Texas?" Rick's back flinched. Johnny said,
"Thanks a whole lot."
"My family was in Moskva. They die by fire and the blast. Your family dies by water. You see, I know how you feel, but the Soviet Union has survived disasters before, and glaciers move slowly."
"Revolution moves quickly," Leonila said.
"Eh?"
Leonila spoke in rapid Russian. Peter answered in kind. Johnny spoke low-voiced to Rick.
"Let them talk it over. Hell, it's their rocket ship. Listen, Rick, they could have got a helicopter there in time. Rick?"
Rick wasn't listening. Finally, Johnny looked where Rick was looking, down toward the dark mass of Asia. Presently, Leonila switched to English. Almost briskly, almost cheerfully, she said,
"Glaciers move slowly, but revolutions move quickly. Most party members and everyone in the government were great Russians like me, like Peter. Well, too much of great Russia was under the strike. What will be happening now as the Ukrainians, the Georgians, all the subject people realize that Moscow no longer holds their lives? I have tried to convince Comrade General Jakov." "What are you staring at?"
Rick Delanty turned to her, and she shied back. Facial expressions differ among races and cultures, but she knew murderous hate when she saw it. A moment later, Rick moved, but only to give her room at the viewport. There were dozens of tiny sparks above the black cloud cover of Hammerfall. More were coming through. A field of tiny rising sparks, fireflies in formation. Leonila lost her handhold. She drifted back across the width of Hammerlab, held by the hate in Rick's eyes, unable to look away. Peter saw that look and braced himself, one hand gripping hard to moor himself, the other fist clenched and ready. Braced himself to defend the woman from a threat he didn't understand. And Johnny Baker dived in a clean arc across to the communications panel. He turned frequency dials in carefully controlled haste, pushed buttons, and spoke.
Looking Glass, this is White Bird. Looking Glass, Looking Glass, this is White Bird. Soviet Union has launched massive ICBM force. I say again, Soviet rockets are rising. Confirmed observation.
God damn it, the bastards are launching everything they've got.
500 birds, maybe more.
Peter Jakov reached the console. He pulled frantically at circuit breakers. The indicator lights on the panel went out. Baker and Jakov faced each other.
Delancey!
Sir!
Rick launched himself toward Jakov. Even as his body moved across the capsule, Leonila was shouting in Russian. Then Rick had Jakov, but the Russian had gone passive. His face was a mask of hatred to match Rick's.
Send your warning, he said. You will tell them nothing they do not know.
What the hell do you mean?
Rick Delancey shouted.
Look, Peter said.
Leonila's voice was strangely flat.
There is another flare above Moscow. A new one.
Eh?
Johnny Baker looked from the Russian general to the woman, finally let himself drift toward the viewport. He knew already. He knew what it would look like, and he saw it at once. At the edge of the red-orange glare that marked Moscow, a tiny, vivid mushroom bloomed in red and violet-white.
Late strike.
The lie was thick on his tongue, for Hamner Brown was 2 hours past, and his eyes were already searching for the others. He found two small mushroom-shaped clouds and a tiny sun that blossomed as he watched.
Jesus, he said, the whole world's gone crazy.
Gilding the lily, Rick Delancey said. Not enough to get hit by a comet. Some son of a bitch pushed the button. Oh, shit.
All four now watched the scene below. The rising fireflies of Soviet rockets and the sudden blue-white glares across what had been European Russia. Whatever industry might have survived the comet was... madness, Johnny Baker thought. Why? Why? Why?
I don't think we'll be welcome down there, Rick Delancey said.
His voice was strangely calm, and Johnny wondered if Rick had gone crazy, too. He couldn't look at Leonila. Finally, Rick snarled deep in his throat. Just a sound. It had no meaning and was directed at no one. Then he turned and kicked himself away from them all, down the length of Hammer Lab. Jakov was at the other end, near the airlock to the Soyuz, and Johnny Baker had the insane thought that the Russian was going for a concealed weapon. That's what we need. A pistol fight in orbit. Why not? Madness and revenge were fine old traditions where Jakov came from.
That's that, Johnny said quietly. It would have been nice to stick together, the last of the astronauts, but I guess not.
Rick?
Rick was down at the Apollo airlock, and he was cursing, quietly, but loud enough that they could hear. Johnny turned back to watch Jakov. The Russian made no move to open the airlock to the Soyuz. He hung in space, poised as if ready to do something, but he didn't move at all. He was staring down at the stricken earth below. Rick's bellow echoed the length of the cabin.
Shit!
Then,
Sir, the Apollo's in vacuum. Shall I close up my hat and go see if the heat shield's damaged?
Don't bother. Shit!
A hole anywhere in the Apollo would kill them during re-entry. They were back to one spacecraft. Johnny turned back to Peter Jakov, who was still watching through the viewport. A blow to the back of General Jakov's neck right now, before he expects it. Or go back to Russia, as prisoners of war? Hardly. Johnny Baker remembered scenes from the Gulag Archipelago. His hand arched to strike. Rick could handle Leonila, and they'd have... He thought it, but he did nothing. And Peter Jakov turned toward them all and said, carefully, They're moving east. East. They stared at each other, Baker and Jakov, for a moment that stretched endlessly, then both dived frantically toward the communication panel.
Roger, Looking Glass. White Bird out, Johnny Baker said.
You got through,
Rick demanded.
Yeah, at least somebody acknowledged.
Johnny Baker looked down at the roiling mess below.
I think God hears us pretty well up here. I don't see any other way we could have got a message through that.
Skip distances. Random ionization patterns, Jakov said. Johnny Baker shrugged. He wasn't interested in arguing theology. The capsule fell silent as they watched the flight of the missiles. The sparks were going out now as they reached their trajectories. They would light again, but far more brightly. But before the flames died, it had been easy to see that the missiles were not rising to curve over the North Pole. A slim crescent of Earth showed, more than enough to let them orient themselves, and the missiles were plainly moving east, toward China. And there had been the nuclear explosions over Russia. The Chinese had attacked first, and what the hammer had spared was now radioactive hell. Peter's family was down there, Johnny Baker thought, and Leonila's, if she has any. I don't think she does. Jesus, I'm lucky. Anne left Houston weeks ago. Johnny laughed quietly to himself. Anne Baker had no reason to stay in Texas. She'd taken the kids to Las Vegas for a divorce that had probably saved her life. As for Maureen, yeah, Maureen. If any woman could have survived Hammerfall on brains and determination, it was Maureen. She'd said she was going to California with her father. There is much to be done. Peter Jakov was a study in professional detachment, except for the quiet edge in his voice. We cannot survive here more than a few weeks at most. General, we have no onboard computer. You must use your equipment to compute our re-entry. Sure, Johnny said. We will need both of you. Jakov tilted his head toward the other end of the capsule, where Rick Delante seemed huddled in on himself. He'll help when we need him, Baker said. He's got to take this pretty hard. Even if his wife and kids are still alive, even if they got them out, he'll never know it. Not knowing is better, said Peter. Much better. Johnny remembered Moscow, doubly destroyed, and nodded. Perhaps Dr. Malik should administer a tranquilizer, Jakov was saying. I told you, Colonel Delante will be all right, Johnny Baker said. Rick, we need a conference.
Sure.
Why? Jakov demanded. Why did they do it? The sudden question did not surprise Baker. He'd been wondering when Jakov would say something.
You know why, Leonila Malik said. She left her place at the viewport. Our government had already coveted China. With the threat of glaciers coming, Russians have only one place to go. Europe has been destroyed, and there is very little to the south. If we can reach that conclusion, the Chinese can also.
And so they attacked, Jakov said. But not in time. We were able to launch our own strike.
So where will we land? Leonila asked.
You are very calm about this, Jakov said. Do you not care that your country has been destroyed?
I care both less and more than you think, she said. It was my homeland, but it was not my country. Stalin killed my country. In any event, we cannot go there now. We would land in the middle of a war, if we could find a place to land at all.
We are officers of the Soviet Union, and this war is not over, Jakov said.
Balls.
They all turned toward Rick Delante. Balls, he said again.
You know damn well there's nothing you can do down there. Where would you go? Into China to wait for the Red Army? Or down into the fallout to wait for glaciers? For Christ's sake, Peter, that war's not your war, even if you're crazy enough to believe it's still going on. It's over for you.
So where do we go? Jakov demanded.
Southern Hemisphere, Leonila said. Weather patterns do not usually cross the equator, and most of the strikes were in the Northern Hemisphere. I believe we will find that Australia and South Africa are undamaged industrial societies. Australia would be difficult to achieve from this orbit. We would have little control over where we landed, and we would starve if we came down in the outback. South Africa...
Johnny's laugh was bitter. Rick said, "If it's all the same to you, I'd rather stay here." They all laughed. Baker felt the tension easing slightly.
"Look," he said, "we could probably manage South America, and we wouldn't find much damage there, but
Why bother? We'd be four strangers, and none of us speaks the language. I suggest we go home. Our home. We can set down pretty close to where we aim for, and you'll be two strangers with native guides. And you know English.
Things are pretty bad, Delante said.
Sure.
So where?
California. High farming country in California. There won't be glaciers there for a long time.
Leonila said nothing.
Peter said,
earthquakes.
You know it, but they'll be over before we can land. The shock waves must have triggered every fault there is. There won't be another earthquake in California for 100 years.
Whatever we do, it must be quickly, Peter said. He pointed to the status board. We are losing air, and we are losing power. If we do not act quickly, we will be unable to act at all. You say California. Will two communists be welcome there?
Leonila looked at him strangely, as if she were about to say something, but she didn't.
Better there than other places, Baker said. We wouldn't want the South or the Midwest.
Johnny, there's going to be people down there who think this was all a Rusky plot, Rick Delante said.
Yes, again, more in the Midwest and South than in California. And the East is gone. What else is left? Besides, look, we're heroes, all of us, the last men in space.
If he was trying to convince himself, it wasn't working.
Leonila and Peter exchanged glances. They spoke softly in Russian.
Can you imagine what the KGB would do if we came down in an American space capsule?
Leonila asked.
Are the Americans such fools as well?
Rick Delante's reply was a soft, sad chuckle.
We're not in quite the same boat, he said. I wouldn't worry about the FBI. It's the righteous, patriotic citizens.
Leonila frowned the question.
Well, Rick said, what's to worry? We're coming down in a Soviet spacecraft, plainly marked with a hammer and sickle, and that big CCCP.
Better that than a Mars symbol, Johnny Baker said.
No one laughed.
Hell, Rick said. If we had any choice, that wouldn't be the world we'd land on. You'd think people would get together after this, but I doubt they will.
Some will, Baker said.
Sure. Look, Johnny, half the people are dead, and the rest will be fighting over what's left of the food. Strange weather ruins crops, you know that. A lot of the survivors won't get through another winter.
Leonila shivered.
She had known people who lived, barely, through the great famine in the Ukraine that followed Stalin's ascension to the throne of the Tsars.
But if there's any civilization left down there, anybody who cares about what we've done, it'll be in California.
Rick Delante said.
We've got the records from Hamner Brown. Last space mission
for a long time, Peter said.
Yeah, and we've got to save the records, so it will mean something.
Peter Jakov seemed relieved, now that there were no more difficult choices.
Very well. There are atomic power plants in California.
Yes,
perhaps they will survive. Civilization will form around electrical power. That is where we should go.
SAC communications are designed to survive. They are intended to operate even after an atomic attack. They were not designed for planet-wide disaster, but they contain so much redundancy and so many parallel systems that even under the impact of the hammer, messages got through. Major Bennett Roston listened to the chatter on his speaker. Most of it was not intended for him, but he got it anyway. If communications ever stopped, Major Roston would own his missiles, and after the timers ran out, could launch them. It was better that he knew too much than too little.
EWO! EWO! Emergency war orders! All SAC commanders, this is Sync SAC!
General Bambridge's voice came through heavy static. Roston could barely understand him.
The President is dead! Helicopter accident! I say again, the President is dead in a helicopter accident. We have no evidence of hostile attack on the United States. We have no communication with higher authority.
Christ on a crutch, Captain Luce muttered. Now what do we do?
What we're paid for,
Rosten said. Static overlay the speaker's voice.
No report from Beam Muse. Hurricane winds over. Say again. Tornadoes.
Jesus, Luce muttered. He wondered about his family up at ground level. There were shelters at the base. Millie would have sense enough to get to them, wouldn't she? She was an Air Force wife, but she was young, too young, and...
Condition remains red. Say again, condition remains red. Sack out.
We will unlock the target cards, Rosten said. Harold Luce nodded.
Guess that's best, Skipper.
Then, as he'd been trained to do, Luce noted the time in the log. On orders of the CO, the targeting cards and interpretations were removed at 1841 Zulu. Luce used his keys, then turned the combination panel. He took out a deck of IBM cards and laid them on the console. They gave no indication of what they were, but there was a code book that could interpret them. Under normal circumstances, neither Luce nor Rosten knew where their missiles were aimed. Now, though, with good prospects that they'd own the birds, it seemed better to know. Time went by. The speaker blared again.
Apollo reports Soviet missile launch. Say again. Massive. 500. Tiara Tam.
The bastards, Rosten shouted. Lousy red sons of bitches.
Calm, Skipper.
Captain Luce fingered the cards and code book. He looked up at his status board. Their missiles were still sealed. They couldn't launch anything if they wanted to, not without orders from Looking Glass.
Looking Glass, this is Dropkick. Looking Glass, this is Dropkick. We have messages from Soviet Premier. Soviets claim Chinese attack on Soviet Union has been met by missile launches. Soviets request U.S. assistance against Chinese unprovoked attack.
All units, this is SAC. Apollo reports Soviet missiles headed east. Repeat. No. As far as we know.
Squadron commanders, this is Looking Glass. No Soviet attack on United States.
I say again, Soviet attack on China only, not on United States.
The speakers went dead. Luce and Rosten looked at each other. Then they looked at their target cards. Red flags dropped over lights on their status board, and a new digital timer began ticking off seconds. In 4 hours, they would own their birds. A handful of glowing coals scattered across Mexico and the eastern United States. The land strikes of the hammer. Columns of superheated air stream up into the stratosphere, carrying millions of tons of dust and vaporized soil. Winds rush inward toward the rising air. As they cross the turning world, their paths are deflected into half a dozen counterclockwise spirals. Eddies form in the spirals and are thrown off as hurricanes. A mother hurricane forms over Mexico and moves eastward across the Gulf, gaining heat energy from the boiling seawater that covers the Gulf Strike. The hurricane moves north from sea to land and spawns tornadoes as it goes. Hurricane winds drive floodwaters further up the Mississippi Valley. As heated wet air rises above the oceans, cold winds pour down from the Arctic. An enormous front forms along the Ohio Valley. Tornadoes bud and break free and scatter. When the front moves past, another forms, and another behind it, spewing out 100, then 1,000 tornadoes to dance out their fury on the graves of the ruined cities. The fronts move east, more form in the Atlantic, above Europe, across Africa. Rain clouds cover the earth. 3. The Quick and the Dead. Day of wrath and doom impending, David's word with Sybil's blending, heaven and earth in ashes ending. What shall I, frail man, be pleading? Who for me be interceding, when the just are mercy needing? Dies Irae. Rich man, poor man. The value of a thing is what that thing will bring. Legal maxim.
Tim led Eileen over the slippery crest. They stopped to gape down at Tohunga. Tohunga still lived. There was electricity, yellow lights shining from houses that still stood, bright bluish-white fluorescent light from stores with unbroken glass in their windows. Cars moved down Foothill Boulevard. They drove with their lights on in the afternoon gloom, through the windy, rain-swept streets, across foot-thick mud that ran in rivulets across the road. Not many, but they were cars, and they moved. There were police cars in the supermarket parking lot across from Tim and Eileen. There were also armed men in uniform. When Tim and Eileen got closer, they saw that the uniforms were of all styles and ages, and many didn't fit any longer. It was as if everyone who had a uniform had gone home and put it on. The weapons were random. Pistols, shotguns, 22 rifles, Mauser hunting pieces, a few military rifles carried by men in National Guard fatigues. "Food!" Tim shouted. He took Eileen's hand, and they ran toward the shopping center with a new spring in their walk. "I told you," Tim cried. "Civilization!" Two men in outdated army uniforms blocked the supermarket door. They didn't stand aside as Tim and Eileen tried to go in. One of the men had sergeant stripes. He said,
"Yeah?"
"We need to buy something to eat," said Tim.
"Sorry," the sergeant said. "All confiscated."
"But we're hungry," Eileen sounded plaintive, even to herself. "We haven't eaten all day." The other uniformed man spoke. He didn't talk like a soldier. He sounded like an insurance salesman. "There'll be ration cards issued at the old city hall. You'll have to go there to register. I understand they'll be setting up a soup line, too."
"But who's inside the store?"
Eileen pointed an accusing finger at aisles bathed in electric light, where people were piling goods into shopping carts. Some wore uniforms, some didn't.
"Our officers, the supply crew," the sergeant said.
He had been a clerk in a hardware store until that morning.
"They'll tell you about it at City Hall."
He looked at their muddy clothes, and something dawned on him.
"You come from over the hills?"
Tim said. "Yes."
"Jesus," the sergeant said.
"Many more make it out?" the other man asked.
"I don't know."
Tim took Eileen's hand again, holding it as if she might vanish into smoke, the way his dream of normal civilization had vanished.
"We're about dead on our feet," he said. What should we do?"
"Beats me," the sergeant said. "You want my advice? You figure on getting out of here. We're not turning out strangers, not yet, but it stands to reason there's only so much to go around, at least until we get back over the hills and see what's out in the valley. They tell me..."
His voice trailed off.
"Did you see it happen?"
the private asked. "No. The water came pretty high, I guess," Tim said. "But we couldn't see. We just heard it."
"I'll hear it the rest of my life," Eileen said.
There must be a lot of people alive, though. In Burbank, maybe, and the Hollywood Hills."
"Yeah," the private growled. "Too many for us to take care of."
The sergeant peered out into the rain as if trying to see through the Verdugo Hills beyond the parking lot.
"Way too many. You better register at City Hall while they're still taking in strangers. Maybe we won't be if too many come. Over that way," he pointed.
"Thanks." Tim turned away. They started across the parking lot.
"Hey!"
The sergeant came toward them. He held the rifle carelessly. Tim kept watching it. The sergeant reached into his pocket.
"I guess I can spare this. You look like you can use it."
He held out a cellophane-wrapped packet, very small, and turned away before Tim could thank him, as if he didn't want to be thanked.
"What did we get?"
Eileen asked. "Cheese and crackers, about one bite each." He opened the package and used the little plastic stick to dig out cheese from the plastic container. He spread half of it onto crackers. "Here's your share." They munched on the way.
"Never thought this stuff would taste so good," Eileen said. "And it's only been a few hours. Tim, I don't think we ought to stay here. We should get to your observatory if we can."
She remembered what she had seen Patrolman Eric Larson do, and she'd known him. She didn't know these men in their too small uniforms.
but I don't think I can walk that far.
Why walk? Tim pointed to a lighted building. We'll buy a car. The lot held used pickup trucks. Inside the showroom, there were three GMC Blazers, four-wheel drive station wagons. They went in and saw no one. Tim went over to one of the cars.
Perfect, he said. Just what we want.
Tim! He turned at the alarm in her voice. There was a man in the doorway to the shop area. He held a large shotgun. At first, Tim Hamner saw only the gun, barrels pointed toward his head, each as large as a cave. Then he noticed the fat man behind it. Large, not really fat. Yes, he was. Fat. Also beefy, with red face. Expensive clothes. Western string tie with a silver device on it, and a big shotgun.
"You want one of those, do you?" the man said.
"I want to buy one," Tim said. "We're not robbers. I can pay." Tim's voice was filled with angry indignation.
The man stared for a moment, then he lowered the shotgun. His head tilted back. Peal after peal of laughter came from his mouth.
"Pay with what?" he demanded. He could hardly speak for laughing. "With what?"
Tim swallowed the automatic answer. He looked at Eileen, and fear came to him. Money wasn't any good, and he didn't have any money to begin with. He had checks and plastic credit cards, and what were they?
"I don't know," Tim said finally. "Yes, I do. Maybe. I have a place up in the hills, stocked with food and supplies, big enough for a lot of people. I'll take you and your family and let you stay there."
The man stopped laughing.
"Nice offer. Don't need it, but nice. I'm Harry Stimms. I own this place."
"My name is
Timothy Hamner," Stimms said. "I watch TV."
"And you're not interested in my offer?"
"No," Stimms said. "Actually, I don't suppose these cars belong to me anymore. Expect the National Guard Johnnies will take them over pretty quick now. And I've got a place to go."
He looked thoughtful.
"You know, Mr. Hamner, maybe things aren't as bad as they say. You want one of these?"
"Yes."
"Fine. I'll sell you one. The price is $250,000.
Eileen's jaw dropped. Tim's eyes narrowed a second. Talk about being rolled.
"Done. How do I pay?"
"You sign a note for it," Stim said. "Doubt it'll be any good, ever, but just in case."
He picked up the shotgun and kept it cradled in his arms.
"Come on into the office. I've got the note forms. Never made one out for quite that much before."
"I can write small." They drove through inches-deep water on side streets. The wind howled. On either side of the old houses, built long before the Long Beach quake and still standing, were islands of light in the drizzle. Tim's watch said 4 p.m., but outside it was dark, with only a dingy gray except in the headlights. There were no sidewalks, and mud, as well as water, flowed across the blacktop road. Eileen drove carefully, eyes ahead on the road. The radio gave nothing but static.
"Nice car," Eileen said. "Glad it has power steering."
"For a quarter of $1 million it ought to have," Tim said.
"Damn, that frosts me."
Eileen giggled.
"Best deal you ever made in your life, or ever will make," she thought.
"It isn't the car,"
Tim's voice held hurt indignation.
"It was the extra $50,000 he charged for gas and oil and a jack."
Then he laughed.
"And the rope. Mustn't forget the rope.
I'm glad he had extra. I wonder where he's going." Eileen didn't answer. They crested a hill and started down around a bend. There were no more houses. Thick mud covered the road, and she shifted into four-wheel drive.
"I've never been in a car like this before."
"Me neither. Want me to drive?"
"No."
There was water at the bottom of the hill. It came up to the hubcaps, then up to the doors, and Eileen backed away. She drove carefully off the road and onto the embankment beside it. The car tilted dangerously toward the swirling dark water to their left. They went on carefully and slowly.
On their right were the ruins of new houses and condominiums, just far enough away so that they couldn't see any details. A few lights, flashlights, and lanterns moved among the wreckage. Tim wished he'd got a flashlight from the car dealer. They had a spotlight, but it needed to be mounted on the car, and wouldn't be any good until it was. They went around the valley, staying just above the water, and eventually found the road again where it rose out of the flood. Eileen gratefully shifted gears. The road twisted up into the mountains. They passed stopped cars. Someone darted out in front of the blazer and gestured them to halt. He wasn't wearing a shirt, but he held a pistol in his hand. Eileen gunned the car toward him, making him dive off to the side. Then she accelerated. There were gunshots and a crash of glass. Tim looked back in amazement at the neat round hole through the rear window, then above at the exit hole angling up through the roof. Rainwater ran in through the hole and dripped between them. Eileen floorboarded the car, roaring around the curve without braking, and the car had the feathery feeling of an imminent skid. She got around, braked for the next curve, then accelerated again. Tim tried to laugh.
"My new car!"
"Shut up." She was leaning forward against the wheel.
"You all right?"
"No."
"Eileen, I'm not hit. I'm scared. I've got the shakes."
"Me too," he said, but he felt waves of relief wash over him. There had been that tiny moment, only an instant really, when he thought she'd been hit. It had been the most terrifying moment of his life. Now that struck him as strange, because he hadn't seen her since she turned down his proposal. Of course not. He had his pride.
"Tim, there are bridges ahead, and we're getting closer to the fault. The road may be gone,"
she was shouting.
"Not much we can do about it."
"No, we can't go back." She slowed for another curve, then accelerated again. She was still strangling the wheel. She was going to wreck them if she didn't calm down, and he couldn't think of a thing to do about it. The road was often blocked by mudslides, and Eileen finally had slowed to a crawl. Once they took half an hour to get 50 feet. Now, whenever they came to a clear section of road, Tim wished that she would drive faster. But she didn't. She kept the car in first or second gear, and never drove faster than 20 miles an hour, even when the headlights showed long, clear stretches. They drove on interminably. Eventually, Tim stuffed his handkerchief into the hole in the roof. Tim's watch showed 8 p.m., twilight time for Los Angeles, June, but it was as black as ink outside. Rain fell intermittently. The windshield wipers in the blazer were very good, and Stims had showed them how to fill the washers. Eileen used them often. As they rounded a sharp curve, the headlights showed empty space in front of them. Eileen braked hard and brought the car to a stop. The headlights bored small holes in the rainy dark, but there was enough light to show a jagged end to the road. Tim got out in the rain and went toward the edge. When he saw where he stood, he gulped hard and went back to the driver's side. "Back up slow," he commanded. She started to ask why, but the urgent fear in his voice stopped her. Carefully, she put the car into reverse and crawled back.
"Get back there and guide me, damn you!" she shouted.
"Sorry." Tim walked back behind the car and guided her with gestures. Finally, he made chopping motions. She switched off the ignition and got out to see where they'd been. The bridge had been a slender concrete arch spanning a deep gorge. The bridge had fallen in the center, and they'd been well onto it before she stopped. Now they were back on solid ground. They could see nothing. To the left, they felt the loom of a flint and granite cliff rising high above them. On the right, beyond a broad earth hump, was a steep drop into nothing. Ahead was the ruined bridge. There were no lights anywhere, and no sounds except howling wind driving the rain, and far below, sounds of rushing water.
"End of the line," Eileen said.
"I don't know. It's a cinch we can't do anything about it tonight. I guess we stay here until daylight."
"If there's ever any daylight again," she said.
She frowned and began walking up the road. Tim didn't follow. He stood, exhausted, wanting to get back into the car, but reluctant to do it until she came back.
Somehow it would have been cowardly to sit in the car out of the rain while she tramped up the road looking for...
For what? Tim wondered. Finally, she came back and got in. Tim went around and joined her. She began backing up, slowly, this time without his help. She went on, and Tim wanted to ask what she was doing, but he was too tired. She had made a decision, and that was good, because he didn't have to. Eventually, she came to a wide gravel patch to the left side of the road, and carefully backed into it so that the car was off the pavement entirely.
"I don't like it," she said. "There might be a mudslide, but I'd rather be here than on the road. Suppose someone else comes?"
"No one will."
"Probably. Anyway, we're here."
"Beer?" Tim asked.
"Sure."
He took two cans from the six-pack the car salesman had thrown in. He opened one and started to throw the pull tab away.
"Save that."
"Huh? Why?"
"Save everything," Eileen said. "We don't have much. I don't know what we can use those for, but we'll never get more of them.
Save it. Cans, too. Don't crush them."
"Okay.
Here." The beer was lukewarm, like the rain outside. They had nothing else, nothing to eat, and the rain outside was mildly salty. Tim wondered if they could drink it safely. Pretty soon they'd have to.
"At least it's warm," Tim said. "We won't freeze, even at this altitude."
His clothes were damp, and it wasn't really very warm. He wished they'd saved the old raincoat from the first car. For a moment, Tim thought about the Chrysler's owner. Had they killed him by taking his car? That wasn't something to think about. What was?
"Do we save this, or drink it up and be done with it?" Tim asked.
"Better save at least two," Eileen said. Her voice was wooden and emotionless, and Tim wondered if he sounded that way to her. Wordlessly, he opened another pair of cans, and they drank that. Two cans of beer on an empty stomach after the day's excitement, Tim found it had more effect than he could have believed. He almost felt human again. He knew it wouldn't last, but for the moment there was a warm feeling in his stomach and a lightness in his head. He looked toward Eileen. He couldn't see her in the dark. She was only a shape on the seat beside him. He listened to the rain for a few moments longer, then reached for her. She sat stiffly, not moving, neither pushing him away nor responding. Tim moved against her on the seat. His hand went to her shoulder, then down to her breast. Her blouse was damp, but her flesh was warm when he put his hand under the blouse. She still hadn't moved. He moved closer, putting his head to her breasts.
"Is this appropriate?"
Her voice might have been a stranger's. It was Eileen, but detached, from a long way away. "What is?" Tim said. He felt vaguely ashamed of himself. "I'm sorry." The glow from the beer was gone now.
"Don't be. I'll sleep with you, if that's what you want. I'd rather not. Not now."
"Yeah, there have to be better times."
"Not if that's what you really want," she said. "I've been thinking. Were we ever really in love?"
"I asked you to marry me."
"And I wanted to, only I didn't want to marry anybody. Well, we're married now."
Tim was silent in the darkness. He felt an insane urge to giggle. "Mother will be pleased," he thought. "Little Timmy's married now." He wondered where his mother was, and the rest of his family.
"Could I have done anything? Should I have tried? I didn't try. I didn't do anything but run for my life."
"Sure you want me?" he asked.
"Tim, when I came out of Corrigan's and saw you, I was never so glad to see anyone in my life." "Yes."
Was she putting him on? And what was the point of worrying about it?
"We'll learn to love each other," she was saying. "We've been learning it all day, so if..."
She patted his hand that still lay passively on her breast.
"This is what you want. I'm willing."
He sat up and moved away from her.
"Tim, please don't be angry."
"No, that's okay. You're right. It feels wrong. The whole car is wet, and our clothes stick to us. And if you're not tired half to death, I am. Jesus, we came close to driving off that bridge."
She reached to squeeze his hand. Wrong time, wrong place. Hey, how about the Savoy Hotel?
Huh?
Savoy Hotel in London. Elegance. Incredible room service. Huge bathtubs. If this is the wrong place for a love affair, the right place is the Savoy Hotel. Only it's probably underwater. He was babbling. Sure, there's a right place somewhere, but what if we never reach it? Eileen, I damn near didn't get that fence down, and it had to be done. You don't need me. You need Conan the Barbarian. Him for brawn, and you for brains. Will you stop that? I can't. You're the one who kept us going. If you want manly strength, I don't think I have it. I don't have the skills either. I used to know how to hire skills. You carried me down the hill, she said, exaggerating for effect. You knew where to go. You've done all right. He couldn't see her in the dark, but he knew she wasn't laughing at him, because she had a death grip on his hand. He moved toward her again, and she came to him, holding him desperately. He had no sexual urge now, only a feeling of innate protectiveness. Part of his mind knew this was silly, knew that Tim Hamner, however much he might share the ages-old instincts of male Homo sapiens, had neither the training nor the muscles to give them reality. But it was very pleasant to hold Eileen and have her go quietly to sleep with her head in his lap. And after a while, he slept too.
The sea is withdrawing from England. Sluggish with debris, the water that has conquered London flows back toward the Channel. Glutted with human bodies, and the lighter cars, and the wooden walls of older buildings, and the sea-bottom debris that came inland in three monstrous tidal waves, the water must force its way between and around and through mountainous chunks that were all buildings yesterday. Windows that survived the wave break now let the water through. It sifts the interiors as it goes and carries away furniture, bedding, whole department stores full of clothing. Buildings along the Thames have been smashed to their foundations, and even those are being torn loose. Tremendous pressures pry the concrete away in pieces and send them with megatons of mud from the banks down into the riverbed. Tomorrow and forever after, there will be no way to tell where the Savoy Hotel once stood. They woke with cramps, tingling limbs, and the shivers.
What time is it?
Eileen asked. Tim pushed the button on his watch.
1:50.
He shifted uncomfortably.
The stuff we read in lit classes made it sound romantic, this business of sleeping in each other's arms, but it's damned uncomfortable.
She laughed in the dark. Lovely, Tim thought. It was Eileen again, her laugh, and he could imagine her sunburst smile, although he couldn't see it.
"Do these seats do anything?" she asked.
"Dunno." The car had a divided bench seat. Tim reached down, feeling for controls. He found a lever and pulled. The seat back collapsed against the seat behind, not quite horizontal, but a great deal more comfortable than it had been. He told her what he'd done, and she flopped hers back as well. Now they were not quite lying side by side. She moved against him.
"I'm freezing."
"Me too." They huddled together, seeking each other's warmth. They were not very comfortable. Arms got in the way. She put her arm over him, and they lay still for a moment. Then she drew him tightly against her body, pushing her legs against his. She felt warm along her whole length. Suddenly her mouth found his, and she kissed him. That went on for a moment, and she drew away and laughed very softly.
"Still in the mood?" she asked.
"Back in the mood," Tim said, and he gave up on speaking. They kept most of their clothes on, peeling back shirt and blouse and skirt and pants, giggling, reaching under cloth that was needed for warmth, and they coupled suddenly with a fervor that left no room for laughter. It felt right, now. Even the flavor of insanity matched what was happening to the world around them. Afterward, they rested in each other's arms, and Eileen said, "Shoes." So they curled around each other, maintaining contact to wrestle their shoes off. They caressed each other with their toes. They coupled again.
Tim felt the wiry strength of Eileen's legs and arms caging him. She relaxed slowly and sighed, and was out like a light. He pulled her skirt down as far as it would go. She slept soundly, stirring only slightly when he moved. Tim lay awake in the dark, wishing for dawn, wishing for sleep. "Why did we do that?" he wondered. "The night the world ended, and we screw like mad minks here at the end of nowhere on the big Tohunga Canyon Road, with a dead bridge in front of us and 10 million dead behind. In a car seat yet, like a couple of teenagers." She moved slightly, and he put his arm across.